Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this beautiful, at least in Milwaukee, Monday morning, the 21st of May. All things political, the first hour of our program, and our guest is joining us from the University of Chicago. If he was able to get to work this morning, I understand that it's hard for people to get to the Loop area, or probably University of Chicago area today, because of the NATO summit, which is one of the areas, of course, we'll be concentrating on the first hour of our program. Professor Charles Lipson teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. He deals in his research with international cooperation and conflict and political aspects of the world economy. His most recent book is Reliable Partners: How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. And he also is the author of Standing Guard: Protecting Foreign Capital in the 19th and 20th Centuries. He's also written... He has a couple lives going on. He's written extensively and spoken extensively about education and academic integrity. His book, Doing Honest Work in College, How to Prepare Citations, Avoid Plagiarism, and Achieve Real Academic Success, has been published by the University of Chicago Press. We'll be talking about NATO, and I'm sure he's kept his eyes and ears on all that's going on politically in the state of Wisconsin. We will cover that as well. And whatever you would like to look at, this All Things Political Hour, our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And if you'd like to use our Facebook page to send us messages, we love receiving them, and it's fun for you to look at other people's messages and how they've responded to yours. That is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Charles Lipson, always a pleasure. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. I was just listening to Wisconsin Public Radio last night. I download the University of the Air and love listening to those.
You're great.
Really, I do.
I know you do. I know that was an honest statement. You wouldn't lie to us. I think it's wonderful.
No. I have my my super PAC lied to you.
Well, I'm glad you listen. We like to have friends in Chicago. So tell me, how hard is it to get to work today in the city?
Well, it's really easy if you live four blocks from where you work, which is what I do. No, there have been a lot of people who decided to stay home. A lot of businesses gave their employees either the day off or told them to telecommute. There are people in the areas where the protests were planned that probably from an overabundance of caution sort of stocked up on food and so forth before. These are people with memories of 1968, but basically the police presence has been very strong. And while there have been some anarchists and others who've attempted to kind of break out of the orderly, peaceful, and fairly large protests, for the most part it's been very peaceful.
You are entertaining your city's 60 heads of state. That's a lot of responsibility.
Yes, you can tell when groups have a don't have very much clout. They end up with the vice foreign minister of Lutonia or something at their gathering. So there are a lot of those as well. It's not just that the NATO people have been here. There are a lot of associated foreign ministers, other kinds of people around town. So there have been huge numbers of events. Local media, of course, covering it mostly as a can you get to work? Are there protests? But there are big issues to be discussed here at NATO, and I'm happy to talk about them with you when you're ready to do it.
Right. Well, let's do it right now. The transition to Afghan control has been one of the areas of great concern, at least on yesterday's session. Was there disagreement about how much support NATO needs to give in terms of people and money to Afghanistan to achieve a transition? Or does everybody agree we need some support and it needs to go on for a long time?
Everybody agrees that we need some support and that other people should give it.
Right. There we go.
let me give you a kind of rundown of the what I would say are the four big issues, but I want to that are going on at the NATO summit. But I want to make the before giving you those issues, I want to say that every single one of them occurs against the backdrop of a fiscal crisis. That's obvious in Europe, but it's also obvious in the United States. There are really deep tensions about austerity versus yes. continued social spending in Europe. But frankly, there are big tensions in the United States, too. We're facing sequestration of large amounts of military funding. We've already pulled out of Iraq. We're pulling out of Afghanistan. But the four big issues are Afghanistan / Pakistan. Those should really be considered together. The second is Iran and its nuclear ambitions. The third is really missile defense in Europe and what to do about Russia's increasing belligerence, I would say. And the final one, maybe the overarching one, is what is NATO's purpose now that the Cold War is over? Russia's maybe doing something to answer that as it looks tougher and tougher. But in the United States, there's what the administration itself has referred to as a pivot to Asia. That is, we're thinking that NATO, the European focused alliance, may be less the center of our attention than what's going on in Asia with a growing and expanding China.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to Afghanistan, Pakistan, if you'd like.
Yeah, and let's tie in austerity versus social spending to that issue. We've seen some elections in Europe where some countries are saying more yes to social spending than to austerity. How does foreign policy play into that? Social spending, more of that for our country, or does that extend to other countries as well?
Well, it extends everywhere. And a friend of mine, Michael Mandelbaum, at SAIS, the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Frugal Superpower. And I think that frugal is going to be a key word not just for us, but for major NATO partners. The biggest event that's happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks has been the election in France for NATO. The biggest event is the election in France. Françoise Hollande, spelled Holland, but Hollande, and he promised early withdrawal from Afghanistan, and he stated it publicly since the election. It was they were going to withdraw their troops over the next several years. Now they're going to have them withdrawn before the end of this year. This is so the question is, and President Obama himself had stated, remember going into the last election, that Afghanistan was the war that he wanted to focus on, not on Iraq. So his withdrawing from Iraq follows his strong promise. But there are people who have wondered what's going to happen in Afghanistan now that we've got committed dates of withdrawal. The war in Afghanistan, of course, began to take out as a way of taking out the Taliban, who had provided a safe haven for Al Qaeda, and Al Qaeda, of course, was the culprit behind the 9/11 attacks. But it morphed over time into not only taking out the Taliban and trying to kill or capture and degrade Al-Qaeda, but ultimately an attempt to set up some stable replacement regime in Afghanistan. That's proved extremely difficult. It's taken a decade, and we still aren't there. So the goal now is to see if we can train replacement troops. But Afghanistan is a landlocked country, and to get to it, you need cooperation from Pakistan. Now, remember, an element of the Pakistani Secret Service, their CIA plus domestic policing and all the rest, you know, their it's called the ISI, had set up the Taliban in the first place. And they're still a very strong sort of second government in Pakistan. And what happened in, I would say, Kathleen, is that over time, the war that was where we were using Pakistan to be able to get into Afghanistan, now increasingly we've been using our bases in Afghanistan to try to take out these terrorist networks that are in the lawless regions of Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. I seem to think that we get mixed opinions, I do at least, no matter, depending on who we interview on this program, as to A, whether or not Karzai is an honest broker, and B, whether or not there are more trained Afghan troops that are taking over more of the responsibility for defending the country. I don't know what the truth is.
It is hard to tell. I would say that the consensus is that there are more trained troops. The question is whether there are enough. There is also a question about whether and whether there'll be more and more ready by the end of the year. A lot of these issues in Afghanistan and NATO help have to do with whether or not NATO forces can come and help train more Afghan troops. Remember, these troops are largely illiterate. I mean, these are very difficult, primitive conditions. There's also, it's a tribal sector and so forth. The word honest and Karzai are not often used in the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But he is a political survivor. I mean, the best way to look at him is as a kind of weather vane. Think about the strength that the Taliban has, not its strength in popular political support within Afghanistan, but its military strength there. And think of him as just a weather vane. If you knew that the United States and virtually all of its NATO allies were going to be withdrawing by a date certain over the next, say, year and a half, wouldn't you begin to try to come to terms with the other side that's likely to be in power there now? And that's exactly what he's doing.
Let's talk about Zardari and his probably going home empty-handed here, unless he had a rip-roaring great meeting with Secretary of State Clinton. He came to the NATO event and no meeting between Obama and Zardari because of evidently what happened what we did in Pakistan and the supply route issue important to the United States in fighting terrorism, not going to get any help really from Pakistan at this point in time. Is he still there? Is there a chance still of a meeting to look at this issue that's important to us and highly problematic in trying to eradicate terrorism in that lawless region you just talked about?
Well, President Obama is refusing to meet with him, and we've had, of course, a U.S. refusal, and understandably so, to apologize for killing some Pakistani troops. And the reason that there was a refusal is essentially that we had not done anything wrong. It was a terrible mistake that they were killed. There's no question about it.
Yes, yes.
But there is huge anti-Americanism in the country. There is just hatred of essentially many things Western, except for a kind of small elite in some of the cities. There's hatred of Jews. It's a very difficult environment. Hatred of Americans. This is one of the countries that when you do polling, you get the highest numbers of anti-Americans anywhere in the world. So it's not as if he kind of has a free hand. What's happened in a number of countries, Pakistan is an example, but you see it all across what used to be called the Arab Spring, is that when you had sort of dictators who depended heavily upon American political support and foreign aid funds and military support funds, they would sometimes bend a little bit, not a huge amount, but they would bend some. And now that many of the countries of the Arab Spring, not that Pakistan is one of those, but now that there's more sort of popular involvement, you see less of that bending. This has not been a case where sort of the democratic agenda that the United States typically supports has led to good things. It's one of the reasons why in Syria, as much as we'd like to see the Assad family and their brutal dictatorial rule overcome, we're not at all sure what would replace them.
We welcome phone calls. We're talking this hour on All Things Political with Professor Charles Lipson, teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. We're talking about the NATO summit, which wraps up today in Chicago and has been quite an event with 60 heads of state and a lot of issues on the table, and an interesting time for them to meet with recent elections in some European countries, which we covered after those elections. We will talk about U.S. news as well. And what about the whole issue of austerity versus social spending and how that's playing out in the United States? We're also in a presidential election year, and that's very much an issue. Are things substantially different in this country than they are in some European countries? How does Europe play in to the United States in terms of finances as well, and the international picture? Dr. Lipson knows that scene. We have a recall coming up in the state of Wisconsin 2 weeks from tomorrow. We'll ask his thoughts on that, and we'll welcome your phone calls. Here's our number. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Brett Jaspers is answering your calls this morning. He'll chat with you for a moment, and you'll have a nice little chat, and then you'll be on the air. And we'll have a nice little chat. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a few things to keep in mind for the next hour and the next couple days on this program. Anna Quinlan will join us the next hour of the show. She's the author of a memoir, lovely book, really very interesting for those of us of a certain age who are thinking about our lives, where we've been and where we go. The book is Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. Tomorrow, Paul Krugman will be joining us. He has a new book, End This Depression Now. And Wednesday, just a reminder, there's a lot of interest in the recall race. We'll do an hour on that, the first hour of our program. And then Senator Bill Bradley, who also has a new book. We got a lot of reading going on this week. We'll be with us hour number two. This hour, it's All Things Political. 800-486-8655 is our number. Professor Charles Lipson is our guest, and Art in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Art.
Hi. Well, I just got back from Chicago last night, the NATO protests. So I have a lot of thoughts, but the first thing is the atrocious misrepresentation in the local news here of what happened. I mean, I saw the TV news last night, and they said there's 2,000 people. Peace Action alone brought two buses, 117 people. Lots of people from Milwaukee came down by train and by car. So we certainly had 200, maybe 300 people from Milwaukee, and we were like a tiny, tiny segment of that group, you know, nowhere near 10%. So it's 20,000 or more, probably. So that's gross. And the main thing that happened was this extremely moving ceremony of dozens of Afghan and Iraqi veterans, including two from Milwaukee, Scott Olson from Campbellsport, who was in the Madison protests, and then when he went to Occupy Oakland, had his skull broken by the police shooting a projectile at him, throwing their medals back. I saw this in the Vietnam era as well, because they were so ashamed of what they were really sent to do. There was, you know, you have the election, of course, in France that's been mentioned in terms of Hollande, and so there's a real push all over the NATO countries to get rid of this Afghan war. And then you've got the military budget, you know, you got the Ryan budget that passed the House without you know, cutting Medicare and cutting Meals on Wheels and all these programs and not touching the military budget at all. At the same time, that polls have shown that two-thirds of Republican voters, 90% of Democrat voters, favor rather steep cuts in the military so we can serve our needs at home. So it's amazing, I guess, to see reality and see all these people peacefully protesting. None of us saw any violence at all.
My sense is that you're right, that the protests were quite large. That's what you're saying, right? I mean, you're really
emphasizing. Well, I'm sure there were at least 20,000. I mean, I've done a lot of protests. I mean, I was giving out material related to the Cuban Five. I probably hit 1,500 people myself. I didn't hit more than a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the people who were there.
Let me ask you, there were talks there about sort of groups, small groups, that wanted to change it from a peaceful to a more confrontational protest, break out of the group. They're sometimes called the Black Bloc or anarchists or whatever. How did that seem with you? How did the Chicago police seem to be handling it?
Well, there probably were some of those folks. There were certainly, I mean, it's a very youngish crowd. I'm, you know, 64, and it's great to see lots of young people,
there.
And they have all sorts of varied perspectives, and, you know, which is great as a rule. There are some who are anarchists, and that can mean a lot of different things, and there are some folks who, I think fighting with the cops is of some value. That was not anything I saw. It's not anything any of us saw, but after the whole thing was over and as people were leaving and there were thunderstorms starting to break out, according to the media, which, you know, I believe that that's something that did happen. It was a very unrepresentative, small element of what happened yesterday, but apparently the police and some of those folks got into it.
I see. Kathleen, go ahead. Ask whatever questions you want.
What about the significance of, I don't know how many troops gave back their medals. What about the significance of that, Professor Lipson?
I personally think that whenever those things happen, they're a signal that people who have really sacrificed the most or deeply opposed to this. I guess what I would say is that my sense is that these are not nearly the large sort of direct protests against the war that you saw certainly in the Vietnam era or even that you saw a few years ago regarding Iraq. And let me say why. One is that we have already withdrawn from Iraq, and President Obama has promised a withdrawal from Afghanistan. And the second is that it's hard for rational people who are in the movement who want immediate withdrawal and so forth to imagine a president who would be more receptive than President Obama. That is certainly Romney will not be. And additional pressure from his left may put some movement to Obama's position, but unlikely to put very much in the context of the general election. I have one question for Art, which is, what do you think will happen to vulnerable groups in Afghanistan, like women and so forth? Most of the after this withdrawal, most of the people who are in the anti-war movement view themselves, I know, as advocates for human rights and so forth. But the groups that are poised to take power in the absence of either a U.S. fighting against them or U.S. trained forces in Afghanistan fighting against them are kind of the worst kinds of violators of human rights you can imagine. They're anti-democratic, they're theocratic, they're anti-women in the Western sense, and so forth.
Well, it's a very good question, and certainly one that a number of us have talked about. Well, I'll begin by just saying after the U.S. veterans, and there were, I don't know, several dozen, maybe 35, 36 or so, threw away their medals. It was immediately followed by Afghan women, and they told their stories about what it's meant under the U.S. NATO invasion, which were horrendous stories.
So they think, there's been a lot of that, but they can't possibly think it'll be better without them, can they?
There's an Afghan woman who's been very active, was elected to the parliament, etc., and she says the Taliban are bad people, and I certainly agree with that. The Taliban, of course, were armed by the U.S., and that's largely why they took over when the Soviets supported the left government. But she said, until the U.S. and these other forces get out, we can't really, the primary contradiction or whatever you want to call it in Afghanistan seems to be this foreign occupation, whether it's England or the Soviet Union or whether it's U.S. NATO. And until that happens, these folks get more support because, we're for the local Afghans, we're not corrupt, and, maybe we don't think women should get an education, but, look at these people bombing us from halfway around the world. And that's what mobilizes, in part, gets their support. So the Afghan women leadership that I'm aware of, including some very articulate people, say, you guys got to get out of here so we can deal with issues ourselves. And
All right, we need to move on to another caller.
Much.
Thank you very much for your call. Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to talk about allocation of resources to kind of tie into what Art was doing. And it seems, on the one hand, that the conservatives are doing pretty well with starving the beast in terms of their attacks on social programs domestically, but almost on a bipartisan basis in a lot of ways, we still continue to feed the beast in terms of the military spending, and this is a concern to me. And I just wanted to offer some examples of things that are going on that people might relate to in terms of stories that of how people are suffering at home and need to be helped. One of the MSNBC commentators has talked about an average of $1.48 for a meal for food stamps people and how hard it is to live on the money that they get from that. Another situation, there was a lady who was suffering from multiple sclerosis and schizophrenia, was getting a Social Security disability of about $630 a month and couldn't qualify for food stamps. And teachers currently are, I heard about a teacher, a lady's granddaughter who was making $20 to $30 a year and has to work part-time to make ends meet. And finally, this morning in checkout at a grocery store, I heard about somebody who's living in Elm Grove, and they were taking their dog for emotional counseling. Now, this is on a parallel course where statewide Walker's trying to cut people from getting a badger care. So it just seems like our priorities are just crazy, and that we almost, it appears like we live in a world gone mad.
Well, let's look at this issue of austerity versus social spending, budget deficits versus stimulating the economy, how it's playing out now in the United States. It's in different ways than it has in some European countries, but you couldn't have more widely different ideas of what this country needs than what you have on a national level and on a state level here in Wisconsin as we face a recall. I mean, people are at completely different extremes when it comes to what we need to do. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, I think this is what makes the Wisconsin recall election a nationally important issue. And I should say that the politicians always say the next presidential election is the most important of our lifetime. Actually think this is the an election, the first since Reagan versus Carter in 1980, where we really do have alternative visions about what the country should do going forward. I'll only respond indirectly to a couple of the specifics that Jim gave, but I think that the key point he's made, which is that there's a debate now about the allocation of resources, is exactly right. I would say that you have not heard any stories of hunger. He has made the point about food stamps perhaps not being enough for some people and so forth. But you do not see, and I'm old enough to remember when we heard stories of the elderly and others who didn't have enough food. That's really been solved. But the trillions that have been spent on social programs since the big society, LBJ, and so forth, his great society programs, they call them the great society, beginning in the mid-1960s, have not reduced gross levels of poverty and so forth, net levels of poverty and so forth in the country. There's a really, it's not just that there's a high concern in the public about levels of taxation. There are concerns about a couple of other things. One is that the regulatory burden has been slowing growth, and growth is very, very important for everyone. The second thing is that there is genuine concern that the nature of the new economy puts a lot of pressure on ordinary middle-class people. That's not caused by government government policies, but it may be exacerbated or diminished by them. And there is a recognition, I think, among serious people that what's really driving the big problems at the federal level are not spending on any of the current budgetary items, military or domestic, you know, the Department of Health, Health and Human Services, and so forth, it's ordinary domestic spending, but rather the entitlement programs. There's going to be a train wreck. What the Republicans are saying is that the Democrats have not proposed anything serious that would deal with these major long-term problems, and that's the order of the Ryan budget. What's striking to me about the Wisconsin recall election is not simply that increasingly it looks, according to polls, that Barrett is going to have a very difficult time unseating Governor Walker, but also that the public advertising that's being put out is not about the original issues that the recall were about. That is, the recall was originally about his reformulation of laws so that that were much less favorable to organized unions. But that's not who won the Democratic primary. And even in the Democratic primary, they weren't emphasizing those issues. They were simply emphasizing these major wedge issues between Democrats and Republicans. The unions, of course, are all on Barrett's side, and the business, small business, and maybe big corporations and so forth are all on Walker's side. But the basic issues that the recall were about are not essentially being emphasized in the election now, and that tells you that Barrett doesn't think they're winners.
Yeah. He's emphasizing, I think, an ideological divide, which is evident to me. There is a very ideological divide in this state and in the country right now, too.
That's absolutely right. But he's not emphasizing those initial union issues.
Right, I think you're right. Yeah.
That were the source of the recall petition.
Right. Jim, thanks so much for your call. Karen in Madison, hi.
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 Pleased to hear you on the radio. I really enjoy your show, and I'm glad you have someone that's talking about the recall. I just voted, and I voted early at the clerk's office so I can get out the vote on Election Day. And I think one of the problems that I see in our country is that, you know, we don't have the voting that other people in other lands, you know, desire. And so I was just in Turkey, and I went to talk to some people from Iran, and they're all saying we're so lucky to be free. And then when people don't vote, you know, that's just shocking to me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't understand that either in this country, Professor Lipson, because I love to vote. It was drummed into me by my grandparents years ago how important it was to vote.
Why did they say that, Kathleen?
Why did they say that? Because you can affect policy, because because it's your responsibility as a member of a democracy to guide the country, because it's going to affect all of us on so many levels during the course of our lives. It's not meaningless. I hear a lot of people say it's not meaningless. I really disagree with that. It's meaningful. But so many people don't vote. I don't get it. So you explain to us, Professor Lipson, why the majority of people don't vote.
Well, first of all, I completely agree with your grandparents, and it makes a difference. Some so-called rationalist political scientists have always said, well, your vote only makes a difference if it breaks a tie. Well, heck, we've seen in states like Minnesota, where Al Franken was elected by a few hundred votes on a recount and so forth, and we saw in the Florida election sometimes there are only a few votes,
right.
But you couldn't say that in most elections, for example, in Illinois, and still I vote. So why do you vote? I vote because I relish the freedom as an American to go in and cast my vote, and I do it as part of not just a civic responsibility, but I do it with my fellow citizens. I do it as part of a collective activity that we all do. So I appreciate the idea of mail-in voting and early voting, but there's something I must say I like about voting on Election Day with the people up and down the block and knowing that I can go in behind a closed curtain and vote the same way they do or different from the way they do, and I don't have to explain it or defend it or deal with thugs outside. Why do so many people in this country not vote? I don't think the answer is because we make it hard to vote. I don't think that that's the answer. I think the answer is that the basic answer political scientists give is that it's very difficult to tell whether it's because people think a pox on both their houses, or because people think I'm roughly satisfied with the way things are going now, or because they think no matter who I vote for, those guys, meaning the politicians, will still be in charge. It's hard to know why, and there are different reasons why people don't vote, but it's easy to vote in most states. You hardly have to walk more than a few blocks. It's easier to vote than it is to get a cup of coffee at Starbucks or a hamburger at McDonald's. So I wouldn't emphasize it as a civic obligation. I would emphasize it as the same reason that we stand up and sing the national anthem at a baseball game.
Professor Charles Lipson is our guest, and we're talking all things political this hour of the show. He's in Chicago right now. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and of course, the NATO summit has been taking place, continuing through today in Chicago. So we're talking about some of the issues that 60 heads of state, leaders from countries all over the world, are discussing at NATO. And we're looking at austerity and social spending here in the United States. We're talking about the recall election in Wisconsin, because it's a mere 2 weeks away, and we've yet to talk about the presidential race. We need to get into that a little bit. So here's our number to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Anna Quinlan will be joining us. Her latest book is Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, a memoir. I love the first sentence in the book. She's actually 59. She'll turn 60 in July, and that's always a big birthday. Her book begins, "It's odd when I think of the arc of my life, from child to young woman to aging adult. First I was who I was, then I didn't know who I was. Then I invented someone and became her. Then I began to like what I'd invented, and finally, I was what I was, again, Anna Quinlan, second hour of our show. This hour, Professor Charles Lipson teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. Our next caller is Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks to the guest. The common denominator that seems to be avoided when these discussions occur about austerity is the lowest common denominator prevalent, you know, whether you're talking about Europe, Greece, and Spain, and Italy, the U.S. with our national debt, or here in Wisconsin with our previously $3.8 billion budget deficit, and that is the math, the unyielding consequence of compound interest. We have a interest payment just this year nationally of about $300 billion. It's going up to about $1 trillion in 10 years. You know, people talk about social programs being cut. They won't be cut in 10 years. They'll be dissolved if we don't address the consequences of the overspending that we have.
I think Mike's point, first I should say, Mike, even down here in Chicago, I should say this weekend, friends that I was with were talking about the Great Air Show in Oshkosh.
Oh, yes.
I would love to go up there.
You should.
So I should just say that it's not just the bibs and overalls that say, by gosh, we're talking about the air show. But you have absolutely put your finger on the critical issue. It's not, as it sometimes used to be put, the sort of guns versus butter issue. You heard some earlier callers frame it as we're spending too much on the military. If we would cut back, we could keep up all of our social programs. You're putting your finger, I think, much more accurately on the real problem. It's not our military expenditures. You can say they're too high, too low, whatever. But these are not the big drivers of what's going on. What's the big drivers are that we now have an overhang of obligations, that so-called entitlements, in all sorts of things that if you continue just the current programs and don't do any changes, it's impossible to see how the programs themselves won't go broke. Now, if you change some of them in modest ways and you do it well in advance, you've got a chance of changing them and keeping them solvent. But the problem is, until a few years ago, if you proposed any changes, you would be demagogued by the other side. You would be shown pushing an old woman over the cliff. Well, it may be that the programs that are proposed by this Republican or that Republican would be harmful to older people. That's possible. But you have to propose an alternative. And the alternative so far has not really been proposed in very effective ways by the other side. That is, the Obama administration put forward, decided to punt and bring in a group, the Simpson-Bowles Commission. They made a report, and the Obama administration decided not to act on the report. And some of the Obama administration's strongest backers on the committee decided to vote against it on the committee itself. So what you've got is one side, the Ryan side, proposing an incomplete program because they haven't fleshed out the details, and the other side not really saying what they're going to do. I think that what you're seeing generally over the last few years has been that Republicans are saying, we've got to reform entitlements. We need to change the tax code, not to favor the rich, but to simplify it and broaden the tax base. And we need to get some of the regulatory burdens cut back because the current regulatory burdens are suppressing growth. We're now into the slowest, most anemic recovery since the Great Depression. And there's just no way that this economy now can handle the burdens that are being put on it, so say the critics, mostly from the Republican Party. But there are a number of Democrats who agree with them.
But tomorrow we're going to have a guest who's going to say exactly the opposite. Paul Krugman will say exactly the opposite on that, that the retirement age has gone up, that we will be able to make changes in Social Security in order to make it vital for a long period of time, and that this focus on deficit is way off the mark. We need to be stimulating the economy. So I ask you, when you have those, once again, we're back to when you have those wildly different views of what the right way is to go to help the average American, what do?
Well, you hold an election. You hold an election, and nobody is running on Paul Krugman's line. He's been pushing it in the highest profile platform in the United States, a regular column in the New York Times. There is nobody really arguing for austerity in the United States. What you hear from the most stringent critics on the Republican side are that we need to cut back some of the entitlement spending in a slow way, and you need to flatten, simplify the tax base. But nobody on the Republican side is on a flat tax program. It's all progressive taxation. They're agreeing that what happens in the current tax code is it's so complicated that the big companies, the GEs of the world, that can afford to hire very high-priced lobbyists in Washington, end up writing a tax code where they end up paying zero taxes after filing, I don't remember the number, but it was something like 70,000 pages of a tax form, and they end up paying zero. Well, how is this right? So people are saying, let's have a simpler, clearer, fairer tax code. And we also have a situation which I think I'm not urging more taxes be put on the poor, but I don't think it's a good thing for our country if half the people in the United States pay no federal income tax.
Okay, let's go back to phone calls. We have many of them still. Willem in Colfax, hi.
Hi. That last statement that you made, that half the people pay no federal income tax, is kind of a talking point of the right that somehow regular
people don't
pay taxes. But we pay taxes every time we buy gas, every time we buy food, every time we buy beer, every time we buy cigarettes. It's not like people who don't pay high income taxes don't pay any taxes. We all pay taxes. And I think that there's a thing that Justice Brandeis said that applies to this, is that we can have a democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of the few, but we can't have both. And I think that's what's happening. You're talking about simplifying the tax code. Do you think that the Republicans who are passing laws that are written by groups like ALEC and funded by people like the Koch brothers and other multi-millionaires, people who can give the governor $500,000, $250,000 at a crack, are going to solve these problems? I think that's just a pie in the sky. They're not interested in advancing the educational system or the environmental protections of the majority of the people in this state.
All right, I'm sorry,
I'm glad you avoided the talking points. The fact is, paying taxes on cigarettes is not federal income tax. FICA is a huge tax, but it's for a Social Security system that's broken. I'm just saying there is a very fundamental debate right now. I think that's what we have elections for.
And thank you very much for the call. We need to move on to Ari in Milwaukee. We have about a minute left, everybody. Hi, Ari.
Hi. Oh, I only get a minute, and I had so many things I wanted to
Sorry.
Talk about. That's okay. Thank you, really, for the call, taking my call. Thank you to Professor Lipson. I just have, I guess, then I'll stick to the most salient point. You know, there's always going to be these diametrically opposed opinions on how to deal with certain issues. I get that. But the thing that really bothers me the most, and I was listening to it when I started calling in originally, when the gentleman who was at the NATO talks, and I have less than a minute, so I guess I'll skip that too. But the point is, we cut the one thing I think that's so significant to all of this, which is education. So when, it seems to always be one of the first things that gets attacked, one of the first things that gets cut, and yet the more informed people become, the more likely they are to vote. The more informed people become, the more likely they are to be responsible for things within their community. And that starts with simply something as simple as education. I'll take my comments
agree.
Online.
Okay. I agree with that point, but let me just say, we have the second only to Switzerland, we have the highest expenditures of education in the advanced world, but we don't have very good results. So you can't just say we need to throw money at the problem. We've got to rethink how the educational system works in order to give better results to our children. I couldn't agree with you more, Ari. We don't want to cut education, but we can't just keep doing it the same way we've always done it.
Professor Lipson, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Charles Lipson teaches international relations at the University of Chicago, author of many books, most recently Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Brett Jaspers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Just want to remind you, tomorrow Paul Krugman will be with us, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics. His latest book is End This Depression Now, and on Wednesday, Senator Bill Bradley will be with us. We'll be doing a full show on the recall Wednesday at 9. Another hour coming up. Stay with us.